Right, interview with the Right Honourable Des Brown MP, London, 21st April. The interviewer is David Gill. Good afternoon, Mr. Brown.
Good afternoon.
Could you please briefly describe your career to date?
Presumably it's my political career you're interested in.
Correct. Than
my legal career.
Yeah. Well, I was elected in my mid-40s after a career in the law in Scotland, and circumstances which were generated by events, as usually happens in people's lives, the Member of Parliament for Kilmarnock and Loudoun, the constituency I represent and had my home in for the best part of a quarter of a century before I was elected, suffered a stroke immediately before the general election. I was selected by the Labour Party, nominated, selected and elected within about 3 or 4 weeks and became a Member of Parliament. I was a backbench Member of Parliament for 4 years, 1997 to 2001, during which time I was the Parliamentary Private Secretary to both the man who was the Minister for the Armed Forces here, Adam Ingram, who was then a Minister of State in the Northern Ireland office, responsible for security, and then for the Secretary of State of Scotland, or rather it was the other way around, it was the Secretary of State of Scotland first. In 2001, after the election, I was appointed to the Northern Ireland office as a Parliamentary Under-Secretary, where I had responsibility for a number of things, including the criminal justice system, human rights, the victims, and other related matters. And then when we suspended devolution in Northern Ireland, because we had to, I got other wider responsibilities, including health, but I won't bore you with all of that. In 2003, after 2 years in the Northern Ireland office, I was promoted in a reshuffle to be the Minister for Employment, or more accurately, the Minister for Work at the Department for Work and Pensions. I then, after a year, became the Minister for Immigration, and went into the next election in 2005 as the Minister of State for Citizenship and Immigration and the Home Office. Came out of that into a position in the Cabinet as the Chief Secretary to the Treasury. Then I was appointed to this job.
Great, thanks very much.
2006, and then a year later became the Head of State for Scotland.
Perfect, thank you. Now, we've heard a little bit about your past. Can you go into a little bit more detail about the MDA, the reason we're here today, and specifically how important the MDA is to you, to your department, and of course to government as well?
I mean, the first point about the MDA is the relationship that we have with the United States of America. I mean, since May 2006, since my appointment as the Secretary of State for Defense, I've had to work closely, obviously, with our American allies in a number of different areas. Most obviously, we are, you know, deployed with them both in Iraq and Afghanistan, but our relationship is much more extensive than that, and we have very close working relationships with them in NATO. We have that relationship for very obvious historical reasons, but it is sustained by our shared values and trust that we have in each other, which is quite substantial. And the MDA, I don't think, is any different. It just represents one of those areas where the UK-US relationship is closest. We have, I think, an awesome responsibility as a nuclear weapon state to ensure the safety, security and reliability in terms of the maintenance of our nuclear warheads. And we have also an obligation to provide that assurance about our nuclear weapons in a manner that's consistent with our obligations under the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, which was agreed in 1998. So, like others, we've developed, like the United States in particular, a program of leading edge research in order to do that. And that program benefits presently from this long-standing relationship, this 50-year relationship that we have with the United States, particularly with our scientists, including the sharing of data, experimental results, peer review, and the use of their test facilities, which we couldn't replicate, certainly not without massive investment, and it's unnecessary to be able to give us access to them. And the MDA is the vehicle that allows that collaboration to take place, so that's crucially important. Not to mention, if for the cooperation that we have in relation to nuclear propulsion, which is particularly relevant at the moment, cost-effective regeneration of our design capability in support of future deterrent program is important to this for collaboration activities with the US Naval Reactors Organization, recently got reinvigorated and are proving to be mutually beneficial to both countries.
Now, clearly, you weren't involved in the MDA, okay? But being a serving politician yourself, can you envisage the thoughts that the politicians at the time may have had 50 years ago that the MDA was born?
Well, I think you have to operate on the basis that we consistently, are more comfortable with the United States as an ally, you know, than almost any other country in the world. I mean, we are, I think, currently in NATO, developing very strong relationships with some of our European partners. I mean, I could identify a number of them for you, but it's becoming known that, you know, a number of European partners are making a significant contribution now, in particular in Afghanistan, and, you know, we're developing the kind of trust and relationship that we have with the United States. So that obviously is the background to 1958. The other important element to the background was that it was a member of the nuclear arms race. There was a worry about nuclear proliferation. So it seemed to be, it would be logical. I mean, I can't read into the mind of those politicians. We can all read their memoirs and, you know, and what they had to say at the time, but it just seems to me that the MDA came about because the politicians both here in the United States recognised that mutually there would be defence benefits and close cooperation. We both had something to bring to this, and you know, our expertise and growing ability in this area in that context is going to have a multiplier effect of what the States would bring in, vice versa.
Okay. Now, I know you've only been in this position for a relatively short amount of time, but I'd be interested in hearing about your highlights for your selections of cooperation under this particular agreement.
I mean, the very obvious highlight is the most recent event under this agreement, which was the exchange of letters in December 2006 between our Prime Minister and the President of the United States on the UK's future deterrent requirement. I think it was a particularly important achievement for us, and it was underpinned by this 50 years of cooperation that we've had. Of course, you know, I mean, historically there have been other achievements, but I wasn't, not in my career. So if you want to know from my career what the most important achievement has been, was the ease with which we were able to conclude and determine that exchange of letters, which is just important to us.
What do you believe are the key benefits as facilitated by the MDA to the UK?
Well, the first of them, I think, is pretty obvious now. You know, we live in an environment of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. So we accept that obligation to rely on stewardship of a stockpile by the development of a science-based program, because we deny ourselves live testing quite rightly in terms of our obligations. But we still have to ensure the continued safety, security, and performance of our nuclear stockpile. It's a very demanding scientific challenge, you know, and we're significantly aided in that by the cooperation that we have. My attention was drawn in preparation for this interview to an article written in 2002 in Nature by our then chief scientific advisor, whom I didn't have the pleasure of knowing, Sir Keith O'Nien, I suspect you pronounce his name, which described in detail the physics, the material and engineering challenges of a program of this nature, and the role of such technologies as high energy density laser experiments, plutonium hydrodynamic experiments, and the computer simulation of imploding nuclear warheads. I mean, I always go into this detail. I don't carry it around in my head, and I'm reading this off because it shows you, you know, the complexity of the challenge that we took on. Our ability to share and exchange information, the needs and related US technologies under the NDA is essential, actually, to us, to be honest. I mean, it's deeply useful to us, but it is essential for our stockpile assurance program and, you know, the fundamental, which is the maintenance of safe, secure, and reliable UK warheads. The second point, of course, is that we have an obligation to find the most cost-effective way of achieving these objectives. And increasingly, we've been able to maximise value for money and our nuclear expenditure through programmes of joint research and technology exchange enabled by the MD.
Okay, now we've talked a little bit about the strengths of the agreement. Do you think there are any limits? And if there are limits, what do you think those limits might be?
Well, nuclear collaboration is aimed at harmonising potential requirements and solutions. But it has to be carried out in the context of each party's own laws.
Mm-hmm.
And although this agreement we have predates the NPT, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, our agreement is consistent with it. So that's an obvious limit to it, because it doesn't permit the transfer of atomic weapons between parties, and that doesn't mean just complete atomic weapons, it means, the atomic elements of weapons. But otherwise, if there are limitations, they're more to do with the kind of timing and scope and the extent of our national programs and whether they fit together at any given time. But for the most part, the mechanism of the MDA, which has been proved to be very flexible between the UK and the US, allows us to work around those. Essentially, we have this level of trust and respect which is established and sits between the people who work with each other, mostly the scientists who work with each other, who trust and respect each other. And they work around those limits, but the very obvious limit is the NPT.
So how do you work around those particular problems, the areas of contention?
It's always a challenge to kind of open up an exchange of sensitive national security issues. I have a very good personal working relationship with Bob Gates,
mm-hmm.
who is the Secretary of State for Defence in the United States, Secretary for Defence in the United States. And I think that, the ease with which I got on with him is a function, obviously, of our respective personalities, and I understand that. But it's also a function of the trust that the history, not just the Secretary of State in this government, but in previous governments, bring to that job. And in many areas, not just in this area, if we have difficulties, people know that if they are elevated to the level of that sort of conversation, they will be resolved, and that encourages people to resolve them, And as I point out, scientists, also develop those relationships, and they go back to the point at which the agreement was established, but that's how people work around them. They work around them in the same way in which everybody does in every working environment, by relationships. So it's a testament to successive generations that this has been built upon. The answer is as simple as that.
That's excellent. That's great. Can you see any other limits or pressures stopping the relationship or impacting on the agreement?
Just the limitations that I've identified.
Yeah.
I don't work in this detail, but I'm told that the kind of timing, the scope, and the extent of our national program, and the degree to whether we are in a position to be able to take advantage of the collaboration that's available limits it. But that's what it's about.
Mm.
It's about bringing us all up to speed together, so that we can maximise the work that we do in this very important area. These things are perfectly understandable, it's a function of the skills that you have, the mix of skills that you have, the priority of your programme. And it's also, let me put it to you this way, clearly when we decided that we were going to replace the boats and have a platform for our Trident system, then that generated a degree of challenge for us in terms of expertise and ability, and we had sustained that group of people. We hadn't built submarines of this nature for some time. So we haven't sustained that. So, the Americans are a different part of the cycle in terms of that than we are. And, we need to get to the point where we get to a degree that we may want to take advantage of any expertise they have in this area. We need to get our people up to speed to do that. And I think, we will find the same in all aspects of nuclear energy. The civil nuclear program is generating already that challenge of trying to get people, trained and recruited into this area, because there is an anticipation there would be a massive expansion across the world in nuclear energy.
I was hoping you could ask me a little bit more about the specifics and what some of the exchanges might have been over the last couple of years.
Well, if you will have gathered from the way I've been answering the questions up until now, there's a broad range of exchanges.
Mm.
But I'm told the recent examples, and I won't pretend to you this is carried about in my head, but recent examples include a number of visits and reports which have covered matters as diverse as radiochemistry, safety and security, safety assessment methodology, intelligence obviously, non-proliferation and arms control technology, enhanced surveillance, and facilities and infrastructure.
Great. Okay, thank you. Now, I'd like to go into a little bit more detail, what we've just done there, but for the next part, which would be, what US technical scientific support do you think NICO relies on? I talked about that a little bit briefly before, so if you can give me a little bit more detail.
Well, there's a very active technical and scientific collaborative program, and I think at the heart of it, there is a process of peer review, which is aimed at aiding the sustainment of the capability in terms of the UK nuclear stockpile and some aspects of our submarine propulsion plan. This includes access to experimental test facilities that I referred to earlier that otherwise we wouldn't have available to us. And you know, there is no reason why we should embark upon the replication of hugely expensive facilities by some massive investment program beyond that we're currently implementing, when we can, through this relationship, have access to what the US has. The most important thing is that we are alert to the requirement to conduct all of this activity within the confines of international treaties such as the NPT and the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. In addition to the 58 MDA, of course, there's the 1963 Polaris Sales Agreement, which allows for the transfer of specific data in support of our assessment of the safety and performance of components that we buy from the US. So that's, I think, as far as I'm prepared to go on.
Okay, great.
Technical support.
That was great. So, this is a particularly difficult question, I do appreciate that, but how has the character of the MDA changed over 50 years? I guess what I'm really asking is, has it changed in a noticeable way to you, and specifically over the last two-year period?
I don't want to sound pedantic, but I don't actually think the character of it has changed.
Not that.
It's the implementation of it has, because the environment in which we're working has changed. You know, we signed this agreement in a situation of, deep concern about nuclear proliferation, an arms race between the US and Russia, our clear obligation is that the favoured ally of the United States and there, to work together to create a balance in safety. But and the focus in the early years, was about gaining the maximum yield from the minimum warhead size and weight. But now what we seek to do with this agreement is to maximise the confidence in the safety, security and operation of our nuclear weaponry, but to do that without conducting a live nuclear test. And these requirements just drive a program of simulation and what's called above ground experiments that develops and establishes and demonstrates the appropriate confidence. So that's a principal focus of the agreement and the cooperation that we have now. The second one, of course, is that we are looking more and more now towards the process of deterring state sponsors of terrorism. And the DNA, as it were, of nuclear weaponry is important. Mm-hmm. So we've developed the MDA to become an important vehicle for the development of nuclear forensic capabilities. I actually think that's an appropriate use of the word forensic, to be honest. But anyway, but I think people know what I mean. I mean, what we need to be in a position is to say to potential state sponsors of terrorism that, you hand this stuff over to somebody else and we will know. We will know where it came from. We will be able to bring it back to you and your international obligations. So working on the origin of nuclear material is an important piece of joint work should a terrorist group obtain a nuclear device in years to come. Part of our deterrence of that is to be able to tell the potential state sponsors that we will be able to tell where it came from. So, I mean, I think what I'm saying is that the agreement has stayed true to its character in terms of cooperation, but been flexible enough for us to be able to modify what we do to address a different strategic environment.
Excellent. Now, we touched on this a little bit earlier, but let's return to it now. How do you think the agreement and the exchanges under that agreement need to change to better serve the United States and, of course, the United Kingdom?
Well, I mean, I think to some degree I answered this question in the last answer, but the defensive security environment, the landscape that we operate in, the strategic environment we operate in is much more complicated, and it's much less predictable than the kind of binary, and, you know, when there were two large armies facing each other,
yep.
And there was this, you know, ultimate deterrent lying behind either of them, and there was a kind of sense of balance about it. In the white paper that we published in December 2006, we sought to, and I think successfully, did set out why in that environment the deterrent still had a relevance. I mean, engaging in these issues, of course, lends itself to a lot of simplistic questions, which fail to understand, or some people quite deliberately didn't understand what we were saying, but I think we won that argument. But the kind of drivers for change and the deterrent program are different from those of the Cold War, or even, you know, the prior to the Cold War. It's just the emphasis now is about meeting modern standards of safety and security, and all of that, you know, in an environment where we have denied ourselves quite rightly, you know, the opportunity of life testing, and that's a challenge. And then, you know, there is the point that I made earlier, which is that, you know, our ambition is to use the dynamic of the NPT and our privileged position in that, but very, you know, weighty responsibility that we have to drive the world forward to a world free of nuclear weapons. You know, and we need to, I think, very carefully ensure that that we don't allow these weapons to fall into the hands of terrorists, because that would be a development and proliferation would work against, you know, our common objective. So all of the points I made, you know, about using the collaboration and cooperation with the United States to let the world know what we can do in terms of identifying nuclear material, the deterrent to that happening is very important. And finally, I mean, and I went to Geneva recently, and announced there that we had been working for some time towards the intention that we would be recognised as a testing ground for developing measures that can be taken to encourage further nuclear disarmament, including researching technical measures such as those undertaken by the AWE, the Atomic Weapons Establishment, studying the wider political factors which are needed to achieve a world free of nuclear weapons, and through the nuclear weapons scientists in the AWE and all the rest, we are researching the technical requirements for a robust, effective, and mutually trusted regime for the verification of the destruction of nuclear warheads, but not one that doesn't give away national security or, more importantly, proliferation-sensitive information. So, you know, all of this is the sort of broad description of the current environment that we're in.
Perfect. I've read your speech at Geneva, that was excellent, but we'll come to that in a minute. What I want to speak to you a little bit about before is keeping on the detail of the actual agreement itself. And I'd be interested if you could tell me how you decide, or how the ID decides, what particular topics are collaborated on.
Well, I mean, we have a program, a stockpile assurance program, essentially, for how do we underwrite safety, security, and reliability of our stockpiles. And the Americans have a program too. And I mean, what we seek to do, of course, is we seek by these programs to prove by evidence, you know, the security and the reliability of the weapons that we have. And our respective experts, the communities of experts, and work together to find areas of commonality in terms of our requirements and the program timing. And then they work together to find the best way that we can work together to minimize costs and risks and maximize our robustness through collaboration. So essentially, you know, we share with them what we are doing, they share with us what they are doing, and we find areas where we can work together. I'm sure it's much more complex than that in the detail, but that's how we go about it, and we use the same system, you know, on nuclear propulsion matters. We are very open with the Americans and the others as to where they are, and we look for commonality.
Okay. Now, this is, of course, the 50th year of the MBA, and it leads me to question whether it will last another 50 years. Could you give me your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I've no reason to believe it won't. And what is certain is that this, we want to live, as we know the United States do, in the future in an environment where, you know, we deny ourselves access to live testing. So, you know, we need the, both the technical ability and the technical experts to underwrite that program going forward. And they will face the same challenges as we do, so there's a significant degree of common purpose going forward. I mean, since we last did a live test, you know, we've relied on this peer review. And for peer review to be meaningful, then it has to be, you know, by people who are not just your peers but have that element of independence, and with the MBA we have that, you know, built into the system. I would expect the collaboration to continue, but frankly, I would expect it to grow.
Okay.
Because I think that, you know, the challenges that we face going forward to maintain our stockpiles in a safe and secure fashion are going to become greater. And we will need to extend and strengthen our knowledge and understanding of nuclear sciences, informing, you know, the kind of wider aspects of nuclear defence. And the point I already made about nuclear disarmament, I mean, we have an ambition that, that this process of disarmament will move forward. It may move forward tentatively, hasn't moved significantly for the best part of 10 years. But it is going to move, and sooner or later, progress in nuclear reductions will require the verification of the elimination of warheads. I mean, the French recently announced that they were going to reduce their warheads quite significantly. Not necessarily following our example, but very similar, the nature of President Sarkozy's announcement was very similar to the announcement that we made in the context of the renewal of the Trident boats. So, you know, this is going to become a greater challenge for all of us. And it will be technically challenging, you know, because the world will expect us to verify these reductions and the destruction, and we'll need to be able to do that while respecting our own need for security and our ability, you know, not to give to potential proliferators information. And so I think that's a continuing area of joint work. And another area which is right for collaboration, as I've already identified, is this, you know, area of making sure that the world knows that we will be able to bring home to those who are prepared to consider allowing their weapons to fall into the hands of terrorists where they've come from. And, you know, we're at the beginning of this process, again, in relation to nuclear propulsion, not technical exchange. You know, that will, I think, generate, certainly in the short term for us, quite a lot of technical demand. Who's to tell, you know, what opportunities that they generate for the future, and who's to tell what information that they generate we might want to follow with them, which could have a potential safe civilian use.
Okay. Now, you've largely answered this question, but I think it's worth sharing perhaps more detail, and that would be whether you consider that there is a case for mutual interdependence, because from what you said before, it would seem that you certainly do, but if we could talk about that a little bit more.
I mean, I think you've working together, continued working together within the structure and the character of what we've agreed is important, and I think there will be more room for us to do that. And it will throw up increasingly interesting challenges. But at the end of the day, I mean, we have a strategic requirement, and I think a political requirement also, to maintain a sovereign capability in certain areas. And that will limit the degree of mutual interdependence. You know, we have to be in a position where we are able to sustain as a responsible nuclear owner, both in our nuclear weapons program and in the propulsion program, a degree of sovereign capability that gives us that independence that people know that, you know, the politicians that they elect take responsibility for these awesome weapons. You know, that's what people want to know, and we constantly have to reassure the public, and quite rightly, and politicians. You ask me any demanding questions on this, and that's always going to be, you know, there's always going to be a limit to that. An overriding principle of the engagement in the NDA is that the resource problems may be shared and risks reduced in terms of the exploitation of technical facilities and capabilities. The intellectual capital within our communities is safeguarded, and that's a kind of essential element of this sovereign capability. There needs to be a meaningful level of peer review between our peers. Predicates the maintenance of independence of thought between them.
We've talked a lot about Britain. Let's talk a little bit more widely and try and talk about NATO. What do you think the future is with regards to Britain's nuclear weapons in NATO?
I think the answer to that is very simple. I mean, it's just one sentence, and that is that all of our nuclear weapons will remain assigned to NATO.
Okay. So, how do you think the US will be involved in the UK's future warhead decision then, if not through NATO, will it be changed like that?
Well, I mean, in the 2006 white paper, we explained the decisions on whether and how it may be necessary to refurbish the current nuclear warhead design are likely to be needed in the next parliament.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've no reason to change that. I still think that the next parliament is going to have to address this issue. I mean, currently we assess that the warhead design that we have is likely to last us into the 2020s. But we don't yet have sufficient information to judge precisely how long we can retain these warheads in service. We're doing detailed work in hand, we've got detailed work in hand at the moment about the optimum life of the existing warhead stockpile to analyse the range of options that might be available to replace it. And some of this work is being undertaken with the United States under the NDA.
Okay. Well, let's keep on America. Do you think the UK will then participate in the reliable, the RRWR program?
Well, I mean, as I've explained, you know, currently we are carrying out work to support our analysis of the optimum life of the current warhead and the range of options that may be available to us going forward, and that includes work which refers to the current US programs. But we remain committed to the principle that warhead developments are undertaken on a national basis. It's not clear, actually, at the moment, what the future of the US RRW program might be.
Okay. And you talked today a lot about peer review. Okay. So could you expand on what you mean by peer review, and particularly with regards to the context of cooperation with the US?
I mean, it just refers to scientific terms. I'm not a scientist, or at least I haven't been since I went to secondary school. The independent verification of experimental and theoretical results. The UK's stockpile stewardship effort since we stopped nuclear testing is dependent on above ground experimentation and the modelling of the results data. So it's of great benefit to both us and to the US to have the results of such work verified by independent experts. And the point I was making about the maintenance of this intellectual independence is important to that. I mean, what we don't want is, we don't want one body of scientists. We want two bodies of scientists working together but maintaining, you know, that independence, two complementary bodies of expertise. I mean, I know why scientists and technical people do this, because it increases confidence. You know, you're working crawled all over by people who have the expertise to be able to verify it. I don't think it's particularly difficult to understand why it's important in this area, because a lot of this is leading edge work.
Okay. Now, we talked very briefly about this earlier, and come towards the end of the interview, so I'd like to ask you a little bit more closely about your talk in Geneva, and particularly reference to the Sound Laboratory. And I'd like to ask two quick questions on top of that. Okay, so let's do the official. With reference to your recent talk about the UK as a summit laboratory in Geneva, how do you propose that the MDA can help facilitate these plans? And how do you think other Western states might, such as the USA, become involved?
The specific proposal I made in Geneva was an unclassified technical conference of the P5 nuclear laboratories and the verification of nuclear disarmament. And we hope to have that done before the next NPT review conference in 2010. And we offered to host it. This sort of very much follows on the AWE here in the UK are doing in researching technologies to verify nuclear disarmament. It's a long-term effort, and it requires collective engagement to begin now. And it's important for the five nuclear weapon states to be seen to be working together in this important issue. I think it's important for confidence in the world, you know, in the future of the NPT and or the future of disarmament will seem to be working together. You asked what engagement we're having with the other countries. Well, presently our officials are working with our counterparts in Beijing and Moscow, Paris and Washington to develop the terms of which such a conference could be convened, and the specific objectives that we would have to meet. We're not dictating the pace of this or indeed the terms of this work. I mean, everybody needs to be engaged in formulating the agenda and to be comfortable with its output. I mean, for two reasons, obviously, because it will not be successful otherwise. But in any event, part of this process is to start engaging people on these issues. And, you know, there are indications, I think, from all of these capitals that this is of some interest to them. And the interest is variable in people with qualifications and questions, and I won't go into the detail of that, but I keep on top of all of this. But that we have got their interest, I think, is a step in the right direction. What we need to do is we need to, among ourselves, build trust and confidence in one another through jointly tackling disarmament, non-proliferation issues, discussing the technical requirements for verifying nuclear disarmament through this conference is just one way in which we can do this. I mean, I'm personally committed to developing, in conjunction with the other states, a series of mutual confidence-building measures which will help engender positive atmospherics through the NPT community ahead of that conference. So we're currently working on that. What role will the NDA have in that? Well, I mean, we have this collaboration and, you know, 15 years of it with the United States to our mutual advantage to point to consistently to other countries and say, this is what working together generates.
Great. Now, quick initial question I'd like to ask you is, and this is something that a lot of people have talked about, do you consider there to be any potential problems with this agreement, and particularly your disarmament laboratory presentation? And specifically, what I'm really interested in is whether you see there's a problem in maintaining Trident, but also talking about disarmament and how that's perceived.
I mean, these are two separate but related questions. I mean, I just in the passing, but I'll deal with them in the order in which you asked me them, but it seemed to me striking, but interesting, that the degree of openness with which we embarked upon the process through the white paper and public debate and discussion about the decision to replace the boats on the platform for our system, that degree of openness that we generated encouraged people, I think, to be mistakenly critical of us in relation to the NPT. There have been similar renewals by other parties to the NPT that didn't attract anything like the level of criticism that we did, but they did them quietly, and indeed the previous UK government had carried out a similar process at one stage, not an identical, but a similar process of renewal, without, I recollect anyway, any great debate about the NPT. But I mean, I don't complain about it because I think it's fairly healthy that you get the opportunity to do that, as I will do, explain to you why not only, you know, it's what we are doing consistent with the NPT, but it is in its interest. You asked me if there aren't going to be any difficulties and challenges in relation to driving forward this ambition that we have to engage the P5 countries in this, you know, whole laboratory of disarmament, as it were, or verification of disarmament. Yeah, of course there will be. You know, I mean, we're dealing with countries that have significantly different political agenda and have a different perception of the strategic environment that they live in. But they all are signatories to the NPT, and they all share this common objective to work together towards nuclear disarmament. That's what keeps the other non-nuclear weapon states in the deal with it. And we have an obligation, in my view, to be seen to be working together. And if we can maintain the confidence and trust of our partners who are the nuclear weapon states, just as we have maintained the confidence and trust of the United States and the AMDA, and they with us, then, I mean, I believe that we can move forward, but of course there will be challenges, and you know, there will be changes of government in some of these countries, and you know, you will have to convince people who come into government as other people go out, but that's the nature, you know, of serious foreign policy objectives, and, you know, we have to start. And this whole environment has been walking in mud for far too long. There needs to be some, you know, injection of some dynamic into it. And I think we have done that, and I think we've captured the imagination. And it wasn't just the speech that I made. I mean, Margaret Beckett made a speech since then. The Prime Minister has said things publicly, as has David Miliband, you know. So, you know, this is a coherent policy that we have in which we all understand what we're trying to do, and we're not naive. We don't underestimate how difficult it will be, but we have accepted this challenge of leadership and we will see it through. The second point, which is, you know, how can you renew your system effectively? And I mean, I could argue that, you know, we just votes that we were renewing, mm-hmm. and arguably, you know, we were not covered by the NPT, but I accept the challenge. I mean, the NPT has, in my view, been remarkably successful. We all have concerns about proliferation, and clearly, you know, what's happening in Iran at the moment, what was happening or may still be happening in North Korea, generates deep concern for us, because it's not just about, you know, the fact that these countries are both signatories to the NPT and are denying their obligations, although they are misrepresenting what they're doing. It's the consequences that that will have for their neighbours or other countries that think they sit within their kind of strategic milieu, you know, in terms of proliferation. We have to all deeply worry about what will happen in one of the most volatile parts of the world if Iran gets a nuclear weapon. I mean, what will other countries do if they perceive that that generates a threat to them? And it's the maintenance of that balance, that chemical balance, as I describe it, between nuclear weapon states and non-nuclear weapon states that has been the success of the NPT. And it's been successful at that because people have had confidence in each other in that situation. So non-nuclear weapon states, by and large, with one or two major exceptions, have not sought nuclear weapons. And indeed, countries such as South Africa, such as Brazil, such as but a number of countries have denied themselves, well, I mean, Libya, for example, you know, countries have been able, within the confidence of that environment, to come away from programs. And one of the other really interesting things is, that's happened is that with the disaggregation of, you know, the Soviet Union, with the fact that they have lost control over quite a number of kind of satellite states that were part of that uneasy alliance that they had, countries that have inherited nuclear weapons have given them up.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, they may not yet all have destroyed them, and there may be a legacy there that's a worrying legacy for proliferation terms, but these things have worked. And why have they worked? Because people have had confidence in this treaty. And why have we had confidence in this treaty? Well, substantially because I believe, at least for some of these countries, until such times as we can rid the world of these weapons, then those P5 countries that have spheres of influence give confidence to other countries that they can shelter under the nuclear weapons held by people who behave responsibly. And, you know, it's a fact that's not well known to most people in this country, but the NATO, we do that for the NATO alliance, in part the French do it as well as the United States of America. And there is one construction of that alliance and in detail that suggests that we have an obligation to maintain these weapons. You know, and people ask me when I go around and debate these issues, you know, how can the Italians, how can the French, how can the Spanish, how can, you know, the Germans, how can people who don't have nuclear weapons, who are part of this NATO alliance, rest safely in their bed? Well, the answer to that is because we are. And I mean, I just think, you know, all of this needs to be understood. This is a very significant, delicate balance, but it works. And it's worked to the advantage of the whole of the world since the treaty was agreed. And we need to protect that treaty. And that's quite so crucially important, that we ensure that Iran and that North Korea are made to face up to their responsibilities in terms of that, and that we do. And we are ultra careful to ensure that we observe scrupulously the requirements that are on us.
Excellent. Another quick question before we close. 2 years ago, Tony Blair talked about the certainty of uncertainty with regard to policy. And he said, because there will always be uncertainties, we will always need nuclear weapons. Is that something you still think is true today? And does that mean that we can ever perceive a future where there wouldn't be nuclear weapons?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure that what Tony Blair was saying was that we would always need nuclear weapons, but the world recognised a long time ago, both the nuclear weapons states and the non-nuclear weapons states, that to get themselves out of the consequences of the nuclear arms race, then there needed to be an agreement that allowed everybody to move together.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what we're about is ensuring that we're moving in the right direction. The destination that we all look for is a destination where there are none of these weapons in the world. I mean, frankly, if would we invent these weapons now if we knew, you know, what they would generate as a challenge for later generations? I don't know what the answer to that would be, and I don't give it for other people, but I do know that all of us have an ambition to try and rid the world of these weapons. But what we can't do is we can't uninvent them.
Mm.
You know, and we may well have to honestly say, you know, we will give impetus to this process. It will be a long-term process, but future generations will need to maintain that direction of travel. And, you know, we're not going to be able to do this in my lifetime. The technical challenges of doing it are probably such that we probably couldn't do it in any event. But, I mean, I'm essentially an optimist. And I have to say that despite the fact, you know, that we live in a world which, if you watch 24-hour news and we're all addicts of, you would think was the most dangerous it has ever been. You know, there are many indications that the world is a much safer place for many people than it was, you know, in my lifetime. I mean, I can think of lots of things. I mean, the one thing that I quite often point out to people is that, you know, 29 years ago at the time of the Falklands War, and I may not be entirely accurate about this, but this is nearly damn it, almost every country in Latin and South America, with the exception of Colombia, was a dictatorship, and a military dictatorship at that. Now, it may not be perfect democracy, but it faced a lot of challenges, you know. Who would have believed? We've forgotten, you know, what life was like before the wall came down. And even in Africa, which is bedeviled by conflict, the number of conflicts that are taking place in Africa now are disproportionately quite substantially less than the number that were taking place only 10 years ago, you know. So, you know, I think we have reasons to be optimistic. Of course, we still have the continuing challenge of Middle East peace, which, you know, is a radicalizer for a substantial number of people across the world. But there are problems which are much more difficult to deal with than others.
Okay, so, in closing, this book is about capturing lessons learned from previous generations. So, what is your advice for the next generation of policymakers, planners, and scientists?
Well, I mean, I suppose every, you know, minister of the British government and or the US government would say this, but, you know, certainly as far as our nuclear relationship is concerned, the relationship between the United States and the UK has never been as good. And it's really important that we continue jointly to address the challenges that we face as policymakers of today and those of the future. And we continue with our programme to underwrite the safety, security and reliability of our warheads and our propulsion systems. And that we work together to realise our shared ambition of a world free of nuclear weapons. I mean, I just think it's key that we equip the scientists, the technical experts of the future with the knowledge and skills that they will need to be able to achieve these objectives. And frankly, we won't be able to do that to the extent that we need to unless we find somebody whom we can collaborate with such confidence and trust as we can collaborate with the United States of America.
Great. Mr. Brown, thank you very much.
Thank you.